Welcome to this podcast from Christchurch London. For more information and resources, please go to christchurchlondon.org.
Thanks very much, Liam. Liam said, we work together in Canterbury. If there is any disappointment that Liam isn't in the teaching today, let me just say, Liam and I have worked on many things together over the last a decade or so. And some of those have been, we've worked on plays together, we've written musicals together, we've helped each other prepare for preachers together, we've led kids' weekends away together. So just remember this, I taught Liam everything he knows about puppets and dancing like chickens. Right, okay. So we're looking at life after death and what the Bible says. And as Liam said, we're going to be looking mostly at the Old Testament up until the beginning of the New today. And we've all, I'm sure, got ideas about what happens after we die. And lots of those ideas, I'm sure, come from the Bible, but some of them probably don't. I mean, popular culture is full of ideas of what our future holds. I'm very aware of my hand gestures now, thanks to Liam's introductions. Okay, so we've got lots. There's lots of ideas from culture, from, you know, art to Eric Clapton to Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey. There's all sorts of things that we kind of clearly nobody's seen Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey that tell us about what life is like after we die. But today we're going to go right from the beginning of the Bible and try and work our way through. We're going to try and get our heads around what the Bible says about life after death. And it's quite helpful. I don't know if you guys were here this morning, but it's helpful coming off the back of a talk like today's, which is about how we should have the Bible as our highest authority and how we should be trusting in that. I found it funny that Liam said that we're going to be doing life after death in between the services. So if we get some time, we'll do some murder and see if we can bring you back. Right, a lot of the material, as Liam said, we worked on this together initially 4 years ago, and a lot of the material that we're going to be using today came from a big book by a guy called Tom Wright, who wrote a book called The Resurrection and the Son of God, and lots of what we're saying comes from that. I've unfortunately forgotten it today, which I was hopeful of having just in case any tricky questions came up. I'm just going to flick to the index. Can't do that now. But the first thing I want you to do is, in the handouts, there's a couple of questions right at the top, two questions that I want you to write down. Now, nobody will see these answers. I don't know if we've got pens between us, but I'm sure we could share them out. No one will see these answers, so don't worry about what you write here. But it's just interesting. Hopefully, after 3 weeks, we can look back and see what we kind of wrote at the start of this to see if our thinking has changed at all. And these are the two questions. What does the word resurrection mean to you? And as best you can, describe what will happen to you when you die or after you die. So I'm going to just give you a couple of minutes to write those down. Okay, well, while you finish it off, let me tell you what I thought. I lived for about 10 years as a Christian with this sort of view of what was going to happen after I died until I started looking into this stuff. It had something to do with me being in heaven, and when I died, I would kind of be this sort of translucent, silhouette-y sort of shape in amongst thousands of other translucent sort of shapes, worshipping a big white light, bowing down forever and ever, singing songs. It sort of felt like a very clean soul survivor, constantly kind of worshipping. And to be honest, it didn't thrill me at all. The thought of it just didn't excite me in any way. And not only that, but it kind of affected what I thought the purpose of evangelism was, about making disciples. It was about saving people so that they would go to heaven when they die. And that was how I thought for a lot of the time. And now what I think, after looking at this stuff, is so much more exciting. I'm so excited about our future lives together. And things have changed a lot in terms of what I was thinking. And so what I want to do this morning, I want you to forget everything you know, or everything you think you know, about resurrection and life after death. And we're going to start right from the beginning of the Bible, and we are going to work our way through right up to the beginning of the New Testament. And that's what we're going to do this morning, and then over 2 weeks, Liam is going to look at about 50 years of history. So it seems slightly lazy on his part, but I've got the big chunk to do, first of all. But we're going to work together, we're going to go through the Bible, we're going to do a little bit of group work, and we're going to try and piece together what we can learn from the Old, up until the New Testament, on resurrection and life after death. And so our first exercise this morning is to pretend that we are Joju. Okay, Joju, that's who we are. We're trying to figure out what the Old Testament has to say about life after death. So I want you to forget everything about this guy Jesus and his happy clappy followers. We don't know anything about that. Sorry that you're going to have a weird week in between now coming up. But for this week, you're going to be Joju, okay? And we're going to think what the Old Testament has to say. And here's the first point. The Old Testament has next to nothing to say about heaven, about hell, or about a life after this one. Next to nothing to say about it. And we're just going to kind of work our way through that. And so the first verse we're going to look at today, right at the beginning, Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. You might think, hang on a second, I thought you just said that heaven isn't really mentioned in the Old Testament. And if we look at Genesis 1, and we look at the first five books of the Bible, heaven isn't referred to as the place where, as we can often think, where God is, this place that we go to when we die, but heaven is simply the stuff that isn't on the earth. Everything above us, so the sky, space, and that might make more sense when you look through Genesis 1:20. God says, "Let the birds fly above the earth, across the expanse of the heavens." So unless we think that God's in heaven right now batting these birds away because he's let them fly across the expanse of the heavens, heaven simply means the sky or space or above us. So Genesis 1:1 might be better translated, in the beginning, God created the sky and the earth. Okay? And that is the sort of world that the Old Testament writers are basically looking at. It's a very physical world. It's not so much about the spiritual dynamic, but a very physical world, about earth, about what we're to do with our lives, with our hands, with our bodies, while we're on earth. And God's plan for his people, as Joju, as we're thinking, what is God's plan for our lives? It has to do with these earthly things, and particularly, it has three focuses. So the mainstream view of the Old Testament, the point of life, the three aims of this life are around three, helpfully three L's, okay, around these themes: love, life, and land. So love, our relationships; life, how long we live for and how many children we have, the lives that come after us; and land, the land that we are living on and the land that we are supposed to be working in. So, Genesis 1, 26 to 30. So right at the beginning of the Bible, this is God's plan. This is his plan A. So he says to Adam and Eve, Genesis 1, 26 to 30, then God said, "Let us make man in our image." As we know, that's how God talks. "After our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over the livestock, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So God created man in his image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful, multiply and fill the earth and subdue it, have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth." Do you spot the three L's there? Love, life, and land. The first one, love. God says, "Let us make man in our image." We're supposed to be the image of God on this earth. So the first loving relationship is between us and God. The second is between each other. Obviously, being fruitful and multiplying was difficult if they didn't work in a team. And they were supposed to work together. Life. Be fruitful and multiply. Have lots of babies is the plan of us Jojus. And land, fill the whole earth and subdue it. So that is God's plan A. But as Liam was saying today, in the second act of the Bible story, man completely stuffs that up. As we know, Adam and Eve listen to a snake, they eat some fruit, and then everything is messed up. And so Genesis 3, 16 to 19, God punishes Adam and Eve and the snake, and the punishments center around these three themes of love, life, and land. So Genesis 3, 16 to 19, to the woman he said, I will surely multiply your pain in childbearing life. In pain you shall bring forth children. Your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. And we can think, oh, that's nice. Eve's desire is to be for Adam. But if you look in your Bibles, there's often a note on the word desire, on the word for there, that could be rendered or against. So your desire is for your husband, or your desire is against your husband, and he shall rule over you. And the only other time that word for is used in the Bible is used in the very next chapter, when God talks about Cain and Abel, Cain killing Abel, and God says, sin's desire was for you. So it's not like a positive thing, it's a negative thing, that your desire shall be really for the downfall of your husband, and he shall rule over you. So the loving relationships are damaged. To Adam he said, because you've listened to the voice of your wife and eaten of the tree of which I commanded you not to, cursed is the ground because of you. So land is forfeited there, land is damaged. In pain you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you, and you shall eat of the plants of the field. So land is damaged. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken, for dust you are, and dust you shall return. Life is forfeited. So at one point, Adam and Eve, they had the tree of life in the garden. They were going to eat of that and potentially live forever. But now, God's saying, you're going to die, to dust you're going to return. So love's ruined, life's forfeit, land is corrupted. Joju, us, we're gutted. Things have gone horribly wrong, but God is good. And so God brings forth plan B. And plan B has to do with Noah. And so we move forward a little bit in the Bible. We get to Genesis chapter 9, verse 1. And this sounds incredibly familiar. And God blessed Noah and his sons, and he said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. So as we know, everybody's been wiped out. Now it's just Noah and his family left on the earth. And God, when they come out of the ark, God blesses them, and exactly like he did to Adam and Eve, and he says, be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth. The loving relationship between man and God is back. Suddenly they're in league again, Noah and God. It's for Noah and his sons, and so there's relationship again for the people on earth, and they're to be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth. But unfortunately, man stuffs it up again. So the Bible goes on to say, chapter 10, it shows how they did multiply, but in chapter 11, everybody gets together and they say, let's build for ourselves a tower and let's make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the whole earth. So they've done a couple of good things really well. They're working together in loving relationship. They're multiplying, so there's loads of them, but they don't want to fill the earth. That's their plan. They want to stay where they are. And God said to Noah, be fruitful and fill the whole earth. Chapter 11, they don't want to do that. So God punishes them again, and again it's around these themes. So verses 7 and 8 of chapter 11, God says, come, let us go down there and confuse the language so that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord dispersed them for over the face of the whole earth. Therefore its name was called Babel, because the Lord confused the language of all the earth. And from there the Lord dispersed them over the face of the whole earth. So did you get it? Plan A, plan B, exactly the same. But exactly the same, man fails in the plans. Love, life, and land are forfeited. So the writer, the beginning of the Bible, it's quite clear, as Joju, what we should be aiming for. Notice there's nothing about a life after death involved in this. It's just about these themes of what we should be doing on earth. Joju, we're gutted again. God's still good. So God inaugurates plan C, okay? And this is the key plan that the rest of the Bible is concerned with, and really us as well. And that comes in Genesis 15, 5 to 7. And again, Liam spoke about this morning about Abraham. So Genesis 15, It says, and he brought him outside, talking about Abraham, and he says, look towards the heaven and number the stars if you're able to number them. And then he said to him, so shall your offspring be. So once again, we've got about the relationships, the loving relationships of people, the life as well, in terms of there's going to be lots and lots of babies. And Abraham believed the Lord, and it was counted to him as righteousness. And he said to him, I am the Lord who brought you out from Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to possess. So God is giving Abraham this land, and he is going to be his God. The plan is pretty much the same, except for this. It's scaled right down. Once it was about mankind, the whole of mankind, filling the whole of the earth with their babies and the image of God. Now it's just about one man's family, one tiny plot of land of Israel. And like I say, this is the plan that we as Joju are going to follow for the rest, certainly, of the Old Testament and largely for the New and for us as well. And so when Genesis sums up, when the beginning book of the Bible sums up what is going on and where we're at as Joju, it bases it around these three themes of love, life and land. So verse 50, 22... it says this, Joseph, so one of their kind of key guys, Joseph remained in Egypt, he and his father's house. And then it says this, Joseph lived 110 years. It's saying that to celebrate his life. And Joseph saw Ephraim's children to the third generation. And it's saying that to celebrate the amount of children that he's having. It was a great blessing to us Jews that you would have children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. And so they're celebrating that. But Joseph isn't terribly happy about the situation because he's in the wrong land. So he says to his brothers, I'm about to die, but God will visit you and bring you out of this land and to the land that he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. Then Joseph made the sons of Israel swear by saying, God will surely visit you and you shall carry up my bones from here. And so Joseph wants to be placed. When they get into the land, he wants to be placed in the right land. And the next book, Exodus, opens with the same theme again. And it says this in the first chapter, verse 7, but the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. Yay, it's all going well. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong so that the land was filled with them. But again, they're in the wrong land. So, and finally my point on this, Moses is sent to get them to the right place. And he's met by God. And God repeats a very similar blessing in Exodus 6, verses 7 and 8. I will take you to be my people, and I will be your God. Love between us and God. And between each other, because we're to be a people. And you shall know that I'm the Lord your God, who has brought you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. I will bring you into the land that I swore to give Abraham, Isaac, and to Jacob. I will give it to you to be a possession, because I'm your God. Love, life, and land. This is the mainstream view of the Old Testament, of us as Jews. Love. Love God. Work with God. Love each other. Life. Have lots of babies. Fill the earth. Fill the plot of land that God's given you. And land. Fill not the whole earth, but this small section of what becomes Israel. So that's the mainstream view. Let's just let that sit for a moment. If that was about your life now, how would you be doing? How would your priorities be? Is that how you're living for now? Are you trying to have as many babies as you possibly can? Are you in the right spot where you're supposed to be? And, you know, how's the relationships between each other and with God? Do you spend lots of time with your families? Or do you spend time with your friends? How are we doing? How would it change your life if this is the focus of what we're doing, love, life and land? Just have a think about that. I think my life would be very different if that was the case now. I should say, if you've got any questions as we go through, please just kind of shout out. But are there any questions at that point about love, life and land? Or have I convinced you that that's the mainstream view? That's what, from the beginning of the Bible, this is what us Jews are supposed to be looking at. Convinced? Not convinced? All right, seem all right. Okay, but as we're here not to talk about life on earth, but life afterwards, there are tiny hints that we get throughout the Old Testament of a life beyond this one. There are three minority views that emerge. And these minority views center around, largely around the soul, about us having a kind of soul that goes on to a place but is either sleepy, not really kind of, you know, conscious of anything, or there's a hope for some people for their souls beyond dying, where they might go and meet God. And the third minority view is about resurrection. And so what I want us to do is to split up into six groups. So probably, I reckon, get together in groups of five. And when you've done that, I shall give you the verses you guys are going to look at in groups. And then what I want you to do is to do three things. I want you to select somebody who's going to feedback for the group. And I want that feedbacker to say, what is a key verse you think describes the what happens to your group after you die? A key verse from the number that you're going to be given. And I want you to ask what the original author you think might be thinking. And I want you to answer one final question, which is, when will this take place? Okay, so the three questions you're answering are, is what's a key verse that sums up your position? What was the original author thinking? And thirdly, when will it take place? So get into groups of five or so, and I shall separate out into six groups that we're going to look at in a moment. Okay, how are we doing? Ready to reconvene? Okay, great. Let's do that then. Right, so bear in mind just when we do this that obviously the other groups in the room haven't read the verses that you've read. So they're going to be thinking of things from a completely different way. Is anybody slightly confused about how what things will be like after you die? Anybody slightly concerned? Yeah? Okay. All right, well, we're going to look at this group first, okay? This group is going to be looking at basically whether soul... Well, in fact, I'll let them tell you. What's the key verse that you guys came up with? And if you could read that key verse, what do you think sums up the position? In the notes, it's under next to nothingness, which gives you a hint.
Okay, this is the key verse we found was Genesis 3:19. So it goes, "In the sweat of thy face shalt thou eat bread, till thou return unto the ground. For out of it wast thou taken, for dust thou art, and unto dust shalt thou return."
Great, okay. Dust you are, and dust you shall return. So paint a picture for us of what life is like after we die from these verses.
Okay, from the other verses, the whole idea is that there's no remembrance of God, there's just silence, there's no praise. Like I said, you return to the ground, return to dust. There is nothing... Your memory's gone. there's no working, no planning, no knowledge, and no wisdom.
Sound. Yeah, praise him. Yeah. But it talks about Sheol, doesn't it? It talks about... Have you come across any verses that mention Sheol? Or?
That was in the psalm.
There was in the psalm, was there?
Yeah.
So there's no praise. It's silent. You were dust, and you're dust again. There's no knowledge. There's basically no... nothing. But it mentions this place, Sheol, which I think lots of you guys have kind of come across. It feels like something somewhere, even though you're kind of in the dust and you're pretty much out of it. You're, you know, at best unconscious and asleep. At worst, you're just kind of, you're dust and nothing. And when's this going to happen?
Well, it's not
Just basically after you die, isn't it?
There's no period where you die and then you go somewhere else. It's just as soon as you're dead. So as soon as you lose your life on earth.
Okay, great. Anyone signing up for that one? have we got so disturbing the dead? Was that you guys?
Yeah.
Over there. Excellent. Okay. So key verse. Read out a key verse for us that. That sums it up.
So we're going to go for Isaiah 14:9. "So the grave below is all astir to meet you at your coming. It rouses the spirits of the departed to greet you, all those who are leaders in the world, to make them rise from their thrones, all those who are kings over the nations."
Great. Okay. And paint. So there's kind of a stirring it talks about there. Paint a picture for us.
So the reason we picked that is because we've got another story with Samuel. Well, Saul basically asks someone to bring up the spirit of Samuel so that he can consult him. So it's kind of this sense that the dead are below us somewhere and that they can be disturbed at a particular point. So either by someone calling them up, or in this Isaiah chapter, it seems to be a judgment on the king of Babylon, saying, when you die, you're going to be greeted by all these other spirits coming to the world. But I always drag you down, it kind of feels.
And did you get as far as what the spirits were going to wake up and say?
Yeah. Would you like me to just read all
that? Yeah, go for it, yeah.
They will all respond. They will say to you, you have also become weak as we are. You have become just like us.
So, yeah, okay.
It's pretty grim image.
So the image that kind of conjures in my mind is that these souls are pretty much unconscious, pretty much asleep, unless a great king or a ruler comes down, in which case the great kings and rulers will slightly kind of open their eye and be like, oh, you're coming and you're as weak as us now. It seems a slightly bitter sort of thing that people might be roused from. And then you were saying about the Samuel passage. What does that give us? The Samuel.
So that's all about Saul going to Saul and basically calling out to call judgment. So that's he's like Samuel's basically like, why have you disturbed me? Like, why have you, sort of roused me from wherever I was? And rebukes Samuel very strongly indeed.
Yeah.
And says to Saul that you'll be with him, with me. Like, yeah. I think it's tomorrow. So it's pretty.
Yeah.
As well.
But there is, I guess, a sense there, as you said, he's been roused from somewhere. His spirit has been. In fact, in the Samuel, a medium raises the spirit of Samuel, and she says, "I see a god before me." So she sees this sort of spirit before her, and they recognise that it's Samuel.
He's wearing an old robe. Yeah.
He's wearing an old robe, and he's got a beard. Brilliant. Yeah, and so that must be Samuel. But the interesting thing is that his soul is raised from somewhere. So it's kind of. It's not just about your body. Your body does, your body goes into the ground, but the soul or something is in this place underneath us, as you say, that might be.
We were saying it's pretty odd as well that you have someone who's Samuel who would be like, surely he'd be in heaven, like he's this great prophet.
God. Yeah.
Yeah, he seems to be in the place where all the other rulers of the world
were. Yeah.
So it's almost like an even playing field, like everyone's all in the same place, just the dead.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And when's this going to happen?
It seems to be present continuous, so that the dead are somewhere now and they are disturbed.
Yes.
Like you say, when they became or something. So
yeah.
Happening now.
Joyful. Okay, so what can we learn from these first two things? So this is the first minority view. I've called it kind of soulful sleep. And it's basically this. When we die, we're basically nothing. Our bodies go into the ground. But our spiritual selves, our souls, might be disturbed, and we don't know if it's endless or how long this goes on for, but it doesn't seem to be the main. It's certainly not the thing we're most looking forward to. Life on earth seems better than what is offered in these verses. Would you agree? Okay, right. Okay, let's move on to the next group, which is the hope from the soul. Is this you guys? Hope for the soul, delivered from Sheol. Have you got a key verse? Excellent. Okay, you won't abandon my soul to Sheol and let your Holy One see corruption. Brilliant. Okay, paint a picture. What have you gleaned from these verses? What will death look like?
It was kind of difficult for us because we're obviously seeing it from a New Testament
yep.
perspective. And so we think a certain way, but obviously a Jew reading it wouldn't possibly say it the same way.
So what would Joe do, think?
I guess it's a little bit of hope, but if that's just one verse in the whole of the Old Testament...
Yeah, certainly minority view. Yeah.
And one of our Bibles said it was a prophecy of Jesus as well, but we didn't know if they would have known that.
Exactly.
As they were reading it then.
So that there doesn't seem to be anything that indicates it is a prophecy, but I guess because we know Jesus, we can look back and see that it...
Yeah.
It was prophetic. What might David have been thinking? Or the original writer, I'm not sure this is a Psalm of David or not. What would the original writer have been thinking about?
I eternal pleasures in the presence of God.
Yeah.
So it sounds a little bit like this is a post-death type of a thing.
Okay.
But there's a hint that actually your soul could be in the presence of God, not in, in this place of the dead type.
Yeah.
Of thing. So I guess it's kind of in contrast to the previous group where there was like all dead people in one place and God is okay there.
Yeah, so that at your right hand are pleasures evermore, yeah, which does give hope for a future. You can also see it another way, that he's not thinking about death at all. That you won't let your holy one, you won't abandon my soul to Sheol or let your holy one see corruption. This is a guy that's in desperate trouble, and he's saying to God, "You're not gonna let me die. You're not gonna see corruption at this point," but that he might be expecting to die in a future date. So again, it's pretty unclear kind of when it could happen. I'm saying it's pretty unclear when it might happen. But if he is talking about after death, then there's some kind of hope in there, yeah? Okay, what about the fourth group? Glory after suffering. That was you guys, wasn't it? What's a key verse?
We went for verse 24. Mm-hmm. It says, guide me with your counsel, and afterwards you will receive me to glory.
Great. Afterwards you'll receive me to glory. It does pretty much seem like he's talking about death at this point, and afterwards you'll see his glory. Great. Okay, paint a picture from what you've gleaned from the passages you looked at.
We went back and read the beginning of the psalm and kind of realised that he starts the psalm by sort of complaining about the fact that the wicked prosper and there's no consequences to that. And mm-hmm. He sort of says that he says, but as for me, my feet had almost stumbled, my steps had nearly slipped, for I was envious of the arrogant and I saw the prosperity of the wicked. So first, the major part of the psalm is dominated by that theme. And so he sort of, and then in verse 27 he says, "For behold, those who are far from you shall perish. Put an end to everyone who is unfaithful to you." So he seems to be reassuring himself that ultimately, although they're prospering now, they're going to perish, whereas with him, so yeah, I agree with you. I think there he's talking about something afterwards, that like talking about being received to glory. I don't know, I'm not sure how else I'd explain that without talking about heaven in
Yeah. And does it seem like it's for everybody? I mean, you talked even there, you said about some people are going to be, the evil and wicked are going to perish.
Yeah.
Does the receiving to glory, does that seem like a hope for all of us Jojos, or is it?
No, I don't think so.
No, it's like obedient Jews. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great. And so we said when this would happen, after we die, but possibly in this group, in the same lifetime as well. Okay. So what do we get from these two groups? So we might glean that there's such a thing as an eternal dwelling for the soul. We might get that. Where there's going to be pleasures evermore. This group as well, your verses talked about when some will be ruling over others. There was a sense of ruling as well. So some are kind of in charge and some are being ruled over. But that there'll be destruction and perishing for those who disobey God. Okay, so we've got something. Yeah, go for it.
I think the implications as well in the text, it implies that sort of judgment as well.
Yeah.
Because the contrast between the wicked and those who are actually.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So, from nothingness to the soul, and then you come to judgment there, I think.
There's a judgment element in there as well, yeah, which we haven't really had that before. Yeah, very true. Okay, group five. Who had the first three verses? Starting Daniel 12.
Yeah.
Is that you guys? Okay, key verse for.
Well, we like Daniel 12.
Yeah, yeah. What does that say? Fantastic.
We were doing a bit more chirpy.
Yeah, good, yeah.
It was
there's all the verses we're talking about sort of rising up after death. It's quite bodily. The Isaiah verse was about bodily bodies.
Yeah.
We're not sure when it's going to happen in the future.
Okay, great. You also had the Hosea verse as well, didn't you? What might the original writers be thinking about? So is it definitely after death, do you think?
It's difficult to say. First of all, it talks about redeeming them from death.
Yeah, shall I ransom them from the power of Sheol, or shall I redeem them from death?
It could apply to Israel, generally, just individuals.
Yeah, very true.
No.
Yeah. Yeah, again, if we forget about kind of the things that we think we know, shall I redeem them from the power of Sheol? Shall I ransom them from the power of Sheol? Shall I redeem them from death? O death, where are your plagues? O Sheol, where is your sting? You recognize those verses? O compassion is hidden from my eyes. It seems that God, in these verses, it's a judgment on Israel. And so when he says, shall I redeem them from death? The answer at this point seems to be, no, I shan't. I'm going to let them go on with their suffering. So they're like with this group down here, when we read these verses, because we know what goes on in the New Testament and our lives now, we can think, and because Paul references this verse, which we'll come back to, we can think that our salvation and resurrection are all implied here. But when the original writers are writing these things, sometimes they're just thinking, I'm going to escape death because I'm in a dangerous spot at this moment. I might die, but God can get me out of this. Or God's saying, shall I stop these guys killing you, or shall I not? Shall this be your punishment? And as you said, we're not quite sure when it's going to happen. It's going to, you know. But the Daniel verse is an absolute key, because that does seem, that is very much seems like it's about after we die, and many who those who sleep in the dust of the earth. So we've heard dust a lot. That's very death kind of language for the Old Testament. Shall awake, some to everlasting life, some to shame and everlasting contempt. So it seems like it's going to be an ongoing thing for some people, some everlasting life, some everlasting death. And as you pointed out, it sounds like the body. It's not just talking about the soul now. Some are going to awake. Their bodies seem to be like they're going to get up. Okay, group six, final group of the wake up to resurrection bit. What's your key verse?
Ezekiel 37.
Okay.
14. That's the Valley of Dry Bones.
Yeah. Sure.
Dry bones in a valley, brought to life, talking about ligaments coming together, pulling the bones together in an instant, and then breath being breathed into these, life being breathed into these bodies.
Yeah.
And that they will know, and it says that they will know God, and they will know that God did this to them.
Yeah. Great, great, great. Okay. Paint a picture of life after death.
Knowing God.
Great.
That was also a key thing in some of the other ones we looked at, like Hosea. But the idea of meeting your maker, as it was, and actually having a relationship with him at that point.
Yep. Anything else? A physical one. Yeah. Really key. And again, there's a verse that you had, Isaiah 53, which we, again, take very much to mean about Jesus, because it does mean about Jesus, but the original writer, when he writes this, may not have been thinking about a Messiah or about how we think of it now. And they made his grave with the wicked, so we know he dies, and it was the will of the Lord to crush him. But then it goes on to say, he shall see his offspring and he shall prolong his days. So he's going to be killed, but he'll still see his children and have long days, which is, it's just a confusing picture. And also the Ezekiel passage, again, if you read it in the context, there's a, you know, we know, some of us may know that kind of passage about the dry bones being raised and being clothed in flesh, but it seems like a metaphorical picture of judgment when you read it in context, that God's going to revive his people metaphorically, not necessarily with the idea of resurrected bodies. So it's just, they're very, very kind of, they're minority views. There's just hints. They're not clear in any way. Daniel 12 is by far the clearest that we get. So where are we left at the end of the Old Testament? The mainstream view. It's about the three L's. What are they? Love, life, and land. That is what 99% of us Jews are looking for. Love, life, and land. And then we get these three minority views. This soulful sleep is the first, that there's basically next to nothing after death, but our souls might kind of go somewhere that might get disturbed from time to time. Or there's minority view number two, which is that there's some hope for our souls after death, and that some of us, if we're really worthy, we might get to see, be received by God after we die. But it's not for everybody. It's certainly not for the wicked, and it's probably only for a few select of us Jews. And the third minority view is your body wakes up again. You die, and then you get back up to everlasting life. You sleep, and then you awake. Daniel's the most explicit about it, and we're not sure when it happens. We did get this little nugget of there might be some sort of judgment involved, but again, this is just, they're just tiny little hints. Anybody got any questions about that group work that we just did? Anything that's come up there that makes you think?
Okay, I've got a question.
Yeah.
So Sheol is basically the realm of the dead.
Sheol seems to be the realm of the dead, yeah, where people kind of go to when, yeah. A sort of place for the soul. Yeah, Lewis, yeah.
Am I right in saying then that for Joe, there was no sort of fixed idea of what would happen to them after they died? So if they went to an elder, if they went to a priest or whatever,
yeah.
And asked that question, there would be a sort of lack of an answer.
Definitely. If they went to Liam and said, what's going to happen? What's going to happen after we die? Then Liam would just say, get on with your relationships, have babies, and look at the land. Don't, you know. That would be the first port of call for an answer of that. It's just not, we're just not even thinking really very much about an afterlife and any kind of, we're not expecting one. But just these little hints, you might get kind of these kind of little thoughts of, oh. And it seems to be based around the fact that God's love lasts forever, and therefore he's always going to love us. So there's an eternal thing that's going on and that we might hopefully get involved with.
Same question. Great.
Having said all that, when we open page one of the New Testament, the mainstream view is a resurrected life. That's what nearly everybody, nearly all of us Jews, believe in, is a resurrected life. So it begs the question, what happens in those 400 years between the end of the Old Testament and the beginning of the New that changes, flips everything on its head? Because when we get to the New Testament, that is what most people believe, is that we're going to be raised from the dead. So, three things, I think, influence heavily the thinking of us Jews. The first is this, the Greeks. Okay, obviously the Greek Empire was expanding, and in the 3rd century before Christ, there was a Greek king of Egypt who ordered for a Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible, so the Old Testament. So they translated the Old Testament from Hebrew into Greek. Now, what do we know about the Greeks? They love their philosophy. They love their guys like Plato. And Plato was into the idea of immortality. He wasn't into the idea of resurrection. That was, in fact, resurrection, bodies coming back to life, was so minority view that nobody outside the Jewish world believed it at all. Nobody was thinking bodies were going to come back to life. It was the Greeks believed in this idea of the soul living on forever, but not the body living on forever. And so, but the fascinating thing happened when they translated the Bible from Hebrew into Greek is that they translated lots of stuff with a resurrection bias. which is really odd. So, for example, we looked at this verse briefly earlier where it says, in the Old Testament, shall I ransom them from the power of Sheol? Shall I redeem them from death? Becomes, I shall rescue them from the hands of Hades, and I shall redeem them from death. See the change there? One is, shall I do it? And the other one is, I shall do it. It's interesting. In Job 14, the Old Testament says, if a man dies, shall he live again? And when you read it, you kind of think the answer is no, he's not going to. But in the Greek translation, the Septuagint, it says, if a man dies, he shall live. Which is odd, right? You kind of think that's... You might think they've just got this wrong. They've just translated it just nonsensibly. It's just silly. But there's three things that give me a air of confidence about the Septuagint. One is this. As I said, the cultural bias would have been towards immortality. It wouldn't have been towards resurrection. It wouldn't have been towards if a man dies, he shall live. It would have been towards if a man dies, his soul shall live forever, maybe. Something like that. But they have translated it against the odds into resurrection. That's just one thing that helps us. Also, the translators who translated it from Hebrew into Greek had access to older manuscripts and more manuscripts than we've got access to now, which would have been helpful to them as well. So they might be translating it much more faithfully, but they would have had access to these manuscripts that we don't have. But thirdly, and probably most importantly, definitely most importantly, Paul, and even more importantly than that, Jesus, both quote from the Septuagint. So they have some confidence in the writing. And but that had a massive impact on us as Jews in our thinking. When you're reading the Greek Old Testament, the resurrection bias comes through much more clearly than it does in the Hebrew one. The second thing that happened are theologians. So at the end of Malachi, it seems that God goes quiet for 400 years. And there are no prophecies. Basically the Old Testament is a story of God breaking in on history and him affecting things. And then suddenly for 400 years, it's absolutely silent. And as Jews who are persecuted from all sorts of different angles, the only thing we can do is what we basically do today is turn to the Bible and say, what does this mean? And go through it and get as much as we can from each of the passages. So we pore over the Bible. And various interpretations of what you get from those passages formed various groups. And so you would have these specific interest groups who would say, this is kind of the main deal, this is the main thing, and they would form into factions. And the two most famous of those are the Pharisees and Sadducees. So they're the guys that we come across in the New Testament. These groups called the Pharisees and Sadducees come about. And these, as Lewis was asking, who would a Jew go to? These are the sorts of guys that Jews went to say, what do these verses mean? What does this mean? And these guys would be giving their answers based on what they believed the Old Testament was to be saying. So the first group, the Pharisees, they believed in the resurrection. They believed in angels and that kind of thing. They didn't always agree on when the resurrection would happen, but they were absolutely sure, because of verses like Daniel 12 that says, some shall be raised to everlasting life, they were sure that it was going to happen. They were absolutely convinced. And they were convinced of our bodies raising to life. So you may know from the Old Testament there are certain cases where God commands for people to be killed, people to be executed for disobeying God. And when the Pharisees had to do that, they would do it in such a way to preserve the body. So if they were going to strangle somebody, they would strangle people in a particular way to preserve as many of the bones as they could. They even poured boiling liquid down people's throats that would kill them, but that would preserve the bones. And then they tried not to stone. They stoned as few people as possible because, again, it would damage the bones which they thought were going to be raised to a body. The Sadducees, on the other hand, they were the ruling elite. They were the priestly family. They did not believe in the resurrection. And one of the key reasons why is because they based all their teaching on the first five books of the Bible, the ones we were looking at, the Jew plan C, plan A, B, and C in action. So they weren't thinking at all about these minority views of resurrection. They just didn't believe it. They didn't see that as the point. So there's a verse in, for example, in Deuteronomy 32. It's in the first five books of the Bible, and it says this: "See now that I, even I, am he, and there is no God beside me. I kill and I make alive. I wound and I heal, and there is no one that can deliver me out of my hand." So the Pharisees and Sadducees would get together, and the Pharisees would say, that's talking about God raising people to life. And the Sadducees were saying, no, it isn't. It's about God in this life right now. And it's not a small debate that these guys were having, the Pharisees and Sadducees. It was massive to them. And I don't know if you mention Acts 23 in the next couple of weeks, but Paul, later, when he's arrested and in trouble, and the Bible says in Acts 23, Paul perceived that one part were Sadducees and the other Pharisees. And so he says this, he said, "Brothers, I'm a Pharisee, a son of the Pharisees, and it's with respect to the hope and the resurrection of the dead that I'm on trial." So he throws it in there to split the group, and a riot starts. And they go absolutely nuts because they're then against each other, the Pharisees and Sadducees. It's a massive debate for them. So that's the second thing that happens. Theologians arise and they start to look into this idea of resurrection, and they're teaching it amongst the people and it's spreading. And the third thing that happens is the Apocrypha. So for a long time, I thought the Apocrypha were the wacky writings, the sort of things that Dan Brown was talking about, you know, the kind of the odd books like Thomas and the Gnostic Gospels, that sort of thing. But it's not. It's the Apocrypha is what the Catholic Bible has in the middle of their Bibles. And it's the writings that carried on over those 400 years. So if you look at the Old Testament, it's full of just, as Liam was saying today, narratives and poetry and stories. And the Apocrypha continues that. It's saying this is what the Jewish people are doing. This is what us Jews are doing. But God's not breaking in and saying anything. But this is what's going on. Here's our poetry and here's our songs and here's our stories about all that time. And so they're not wacky. They're not scripture. Nobody believed they were scripture. The Catholics consider them as secondary scripture, but they're still important writings for us Jews. So they're still kind of everywhere. People are still talking about them. And even in our own Bible, Jude quotes 1 Enoch as part of his writing. So they're not things to be kind of shied away from, but they were really important writings particularly during those 400 years. And the thinking about resurrection just gets more and more front-footed and mainstream. And we're just going to look at a few fascinating elements of that before we finish. And here, clearly, resurrection from the dead, this may blow your mind, it blew mine, means coming back to life in this age. It means you die, and then you get back up again, and you're living again on the earth now. It's not looking forward to a future time of spiritual renewal or a judgment, or in fact the judgment comes into it, but getting back to life in this world, okay? So just going to look at a couple of examples of that. So Hanukkah celebrates the rededication of the temple after the Jews had an uprising. And there's a book called 2 Maccabees. And in 2 Maccabees, verse 7, we read of 7 brothers that are tortured. I think these are in your notes. 7 brothers that are tortured for not eating defiled food. I'm just going to read some of the things that they say just before they die. So the second brother says this. He says this to his oppressors. "You accursed wretch, you dismiss us, our present life, but the king of the universe will raise us up to an everlasting renewal of life because we have died for his laws." He will raise us up to an everlasting renewal of life because we've died for his laws. Then the third brother says this. He stuck out his tongue and courageously stretched forward his hands and said nobly, "I got these from heaven." I don't know how he says that with his tongue stretched out. "I got these from heaven. And because of his laws, I disdain them. And from him, I hope to get them back again." He's saying, you can chop off my arms, you can chop off my tongue, but from him I hope to get them back again. Then the fourth brother says this, when he was near death, it says this in Maccabees, one cannot but choose to die at the hands of mortals and to cherish the hope of God, the hope God gives of being raised again by him. But for you, there will be no resurrection to life. So it comes back to that idea of the wicked being punishment. There will be no resurrection for you, but there's going to be resurrection to life for me. And then the mum gets involved, and she encouraged each of them in their language of their ancestors. Filled with a noble spirit, she said to them, I do not know how you came into being in my womb. It was not I who gave you life and breath, nor I who set in order the elements within each of you. Therefore, the creator of the world, who shaped the beginning of humankind and devised the origin of all things, will in his mercy give life and breath back to you again, since you now forget yourselves for the sake of his laws. Her sons are going to die, and she's saying, God, in his mercy, will give life and breath back to you again. And then the mum speaks to the youngest son. She says this, I beg you, my child, and this is the fascinating one for me, a real key one for me. I beg you, my child, to look at the heaven and the earth and see everything that is in them and recognize that God did not make them out of things that existed. And in the same way, the human race came into being. Do not fear this butcher, but prove worthy of your brothers. Accept death so that in God's mercy, I may get you back again along with your brothers. So the mum isn't expecting to die at this point. But she is expecting her sons to die and then to come back to life and for her to be able to see them and continue her relationship with them. Let's move on. For this, I'm going to need Liam. He knew this was coming. There's a guy called Razi. He's an elder of the Jewish people. We're just going to grab a chair, Liam, and come on up. Yeah, well, you did this to me last time you taught this, so... okay, so Razi is cornered by a mob of people, and so he doesn't want to be killed by them, so he stabs himself. Yes, very good. But it says this in 2 Maccabees 14, but in the heat of the struggle, he did not hit exactly. Yeah, whoops. And the crowd was now rushing in through the doors, so he's in the temple. In the temple? Yeah. He courageously ran up on the wall. And bravely threw himself down into the crowd. No. But as he drew back, has anybody been to a concert where stage diving happens where people part? And the stage. Yeah, okay. But as he drew back, a space opened and he fell into the middle of the empty space. This is a guy that stabbed himself, leapt off a wall, fallen into the empty space. Still alive and aflame with anger, he rose. And though his blood gushed forth and his wounds were severe, he ran through the crowd and standing upon a steep rock with his blood now completely drained from him. He tore out his entrails, took them in both hands, and hurled them at the crowd, calling upon the Lord of life and spirit to give them back to him again. He's literally ripped out his insides, throwing them at people, and asked God to give back his insides again. Here's a guy who's desperately hoping for a future resurrection. He absolutely believes it. And finally, this is slightly odd, but, that was odd. This is theologically a bit more difficult. In 2 Maccabees verse 12, Judas Maccabeus himself is making a sin offering on behalf of the dead. So he's offering on behalf of those that have already died, who have been discovered to... They've kept idolatrous tokens... And so he's worried about their future resurrection. So he makes an offering on behalf of the dead. And it says this in 2 Maccabees 12. For if he were not expecting that those who had fallen would rise again, it would have been superfluous and foolish to pray for the dead. But if he was looking to the splendid reward that is laid up for those who fall asleep in godliness, it was a holy and pious thought. Therefore he made atonement for the dead so that they may be delivered from their sin. So he's done that to hope when they get their bodies back, or that, to do it so that they would get their bodies back, they wouldn't be kept in sin. So quickly, I'm going to conclude, and then we'll just take some questions if you've got them. So where have we got to today? Let me just recap. At the beginning, we had the mainstream view that was love, life, and land. That is all 99% of us Jews are living for: love, life, and land. And there are these three minority views that you can kind of have this soulish sleep, that you kind of might be raised if somebody great comes down to death, or that there may be a hope for some of us after we die, that we might be received by God to glory, but again in our soul. Or the third minority view, the most minority-ist of them all, that we will be, our bodies will be raised from the dead. By the time of Jesus, however, the minority view is the majority view, that we're going to come back to life from the dead. Oh, I've missed a whole bit. Let's go back in one second. But that your bodies will be raised, we're not sure when, but probably in this life. Now, just as in fact, let's not bother. There does come a point in the Apocrypha where there is this sense of judgment that comes in as well, that there's going to be some sort of judgment, and on the last days, it starts to say, that's when we're going to be raised. So there's that sort of view as well. And I'll just read one of those, which is from 1 Enoch and chapter 62. It says this: "The righteous and elect ones shall be saved on that day. And from thenceforth, they shall never see the faces of the sinners and the oppressors. The Lord of the spirits will abide over them. They shall eat and rest and rise with that Son of Man forever and ever. The righteous and elect one shall rise from the earth and shall cease being of downcast face. They shall wear garments of glory." So not only is this sense of judgment, but also possibly this Son of Man, this element that will be raised, that some will be raised with this Son of Man, and the righteous and elect ones shall rise from the earth. So no one knew quite how resurrection would happen or when it would happen. And no one really, except for a little verse we just read there, connected resurrection with the Messiah until we get to Christianity and things completely change forever and from there, which is what Liam will look at the next couple of weeks. We got any questions? Yeah?
I had a question about the translation. I know Jesus, because he quoted it, so obviously it would be reliable, but some people would find that as an issue, like, why would they change the meaning?
Yeah, definitely. Well, I think it is a really tricky thing. And I think there's no hard and fast answer as to why we can be completely confident, other than the fact that Jesus quoted from it, really. And so
sure. So I'm actually studying Hebrew at the moment, which is brand new to me, and I've studied a bit of Greek as well, and actually it's a highly fluid, flexible language. And what Andy's not saying is that they took these things which were translated exactly right and then completely changed them. But there's the possibility of both of those being right. And in the translation into Greek, they made a judgment call that said, actually, we think it's this way. So, for example, in Hebrew, there are very often words missing that you have to kind of like figure out from the context what the whole sentence is. So very often you get bits, not the whole sentence. And so originally it could have been ambiguous. It's like, is it saying he shall raise him to the dead, or shall he raise him to the dead? Your word order can be all changed. When the Greeks translated it, for whatever reason, which I think we have to put down to divine inspiration of some sort, they went with a particular translation. And the fascinating thing is that if you read Plato and all the Greek philosophers, there is absolutely no way in the world that they would have gone, I want to make this look like what I want, and therefore go with resurrection, because they just did not believe in resurrection at all. So they just made this completely counterintuitive, hard and fast translation of these passages, which I think can only be because God inspired them. And it's not that they changed the words, they just brought out a totally genuine and permissible translation of them that had by and large been lost previously. And that seems to be then endorsed by Jesus himself and Paul and this. Does that help a bit?
So now I was looking at the different versions on my phone. So the ESV says, shall I? The NIV says, I shall. So just, I mean, we've still today got the two different. How do you know which one to read and follow?
Sure. Yeah, do you mean which English translation to read and follow?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just go with the message on the screen. That's probably why. Yeah.
Right. No. I mean, personally, without getting really into technically sort of actually looking at the text and that sort of thing, it's hard to say. But typically, I think the ESV is the more accurate translation of the two, but I think the NIV is more readable, so I use both of them personally. What we will see as we now get into the New Testament is that the New Testament writers clearly started interpreting things in a particular way, such that I think we are now completely legitimately allowed to read those passages and say that this is talking about a physical resurrection. And so with the light of the New Testament, looking back at it, I would be more inclined to pick the ones that talk about the certainty of resurrection. But obviously, as Joe Jews, you haven't heard my talk from next week yet, and you're not there. So I think I would veer towards the more certain... Was it the ESV was more...
The
ESV was still the shall I believe in. So I was thinking, sure, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've understood to be occasionally less reliable on some things. Yeah. But in this case, well, it's just some of the flexibility of the language. But I think with the knowledge of what happened with Jesus, I think we can be more certain about and be like, I shall raise, you know, man shall live after you've died, those kind of things.
I think regardless of the etymology's definitions, this could be a whole topic, there's the sense of life and death.
Sure.
So this is how we, as Christians, how do we vocalize that to those who actually come to us and say, well, what does your scriptures talk about?
Yeah.
Life and death.
Sure.
Yeah. And I think that's probably the main objective of this topic, just prepare us to the question arises, because we actually know from an Old Testament perspective, and when we come to a New Testament, how more specific it gets.
Yeah, sure.
The Old Testament, what I learned today, is that there's that sense that something is going to take place. You know?
So even if you do treat some of those passages like shall I raise them from Sheol as questions rather than statements, well, we now know the answer to that.
Yeah.
Yes, he shall. So I think that even if you still do treat it like the ESV does as a question, what we know, the implicit answer is no longer no, as people probably would have originally, but yes, because we know Christ and we're in Christ and I'm really next week. But essentially we know now with a greater certainty how to answer that question that was in the original text.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just had something that's probably
Yes. Yeah.
I was just thinking as we were doing all this, is there a Jewish eschatology, or do they have a concept of the end times?
Now, do you mean?
Or just, like, what was their kind of vision of where history was going? Because we obviously are Jesus.
Well, I think that even if they believed in resurrection, they were probably expecting it to happen. The Daniel passage talks about resurrection happening at a particular time of oppression. And so I think that they were, with this land, life and love thing, they were expecting that the dead would be raised at a point when those three things were, plan C was fulfilled, was it completely at work, when they had got the land and they had, because for a very tiny amount of time historically in the Bible does Israel get anywhere near kind of getting the plot of land that God promised them. So I think that they are expecting a time when they will get the full plot of land and that they can continue to have children and multiply and fill that plot of land, subdue it and live life in relationship with God, and that's when they will be raised. it probably wasn't going to be a God's going to bring an end, as we can often think of it, and actually...
Yeah. It was probably to do with eschatology and kingdom, I think, come quite closely together. So, particularly in Daniel, loads of stuff about the kingdom destroying, you know, being like a little stone that smashes the statue and all the other things. I think they probably would have envisioned it being something like, at some point, the Davidic king would come, establish the kingdom, and then that would be the rest of the eternal state. So it'd be something that intervenes in history, and at that point, all the dead are raised. But it is very sketchy.
Yeah.
Do you think it's possible that? So I just suddenly thought, like, you know, when Jesus was talking to the Sadducees, he rebukes them on the resurrection. This is before he's been raised from the dead, which is why I found it interesting. He says, and he quotes the verse where he says, "I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." He says, "Well, God's not the God of the dead, but of the living."
Yeah.
I mean, do you think it's possible that other Jews would have seen it that way before he said it?
Definitely by the time of Jesus. Yeah. We'll look particularly at that next week. But yeah. But I mean, as Emily said, the minority view of resurrection had become the majority view
by that point.
By the time of Jesus. But even then, Jesus takes what was a majority view and twists
it. Yeah.
Thank you for listening. For more information or for further podcasts and downloads, please visit ChristChurchLondon.org.